Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Andy, Don, and Dude.
Lights, camera, action. It's the Album Nerds Podcast. I'm Dude. I got Andy and Don with me. Hey, Andy, you ready to get into some soundtracks?
Hey, buddy. Yeah, you know I am. You know, I had a deep thought earlier today that, you know, the music we listen to during our days, it's kind of like the soundtrack of our lives.
Wow, that is deep.
Yeah.
Very deep.
And this podcast can be the soundtrack to somebody's commute or something.
There you go.
That's right. We're all making little soundtracks.
Every word we say is the music of our lives.
Especially you.
This is the Album Nerds Podcast. Yeah. we love albums, the album format, and talking about them. This week, we have a great show for you. We're going to be discussing soundtrack albums, which is a little outside of the norm for us. Don's going to be asking us a deep question. We're also going to have some shout outs to some albums and album related items that we're digging. And then, of course, we'll spin the wheel of musical discovery to find out what we'll talk about next time. But this week, it's all about those soundtracks.
That's what I'm talking about!
Movie soundtracks play a crucial role in enhancing the emotional impact and storytelling of films, often becoming inseparable from the cinematic experience itself. From curated popular music selections to original works specifically created for a film, great soundtracks have the power to elevate scenes, guide audience emotions, and sometimes become enjoyable listening experiences on our turntables. Today, each of us will present a movie soundtrack.
Yeah, so we've had discussions here at the show of if soundtracks are really albums or if they're just compilations. You know, for those that are of high quality, they do help tell the story of the film or support the film or make a collection of songs that are have a unique relationship to each other. So how did you guys do in your explorations? What other soundtracks did you think about that you didn't end up ultimately going with as your pick for the week?
Yeah, I found myself gravitating towards films from like the 90s and 70s. I guess those are my two favorite eras of film. But the one I almost went with was from the film The Harder They Come, which is a Jamaican film, kind of like a crime drama from the 1972. Features several songs from Jimmy Cliff, a reggae artist from Jamaica, as well as some other local Jamaican artists that helped to kind of popularize reggae in the U.S. in the 70s. The thing that held me back from it, I hadn't really seen the film in its entirety, so helps to have that connection, I think, between the music and the motion on the screen. How about you, Don?
Well, the first place I went to was Pretty in Pink, of course, a John Hughes film who keeps coming up on the show, also directed by Howard Deutsch. The soundtrack features a lot of new wave and punk artists from that time period. The film title actually is based on the Psychedelic Furs song Pretty in Pink, which they re-record for the soundtrack, but also has New Order, The Smiths, Echo and the Bunnymen. Probably the most famous song is Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, If You Leave.
Yeah.
Classic soundtrack.
Good stuff, yeah.
Very 80s.
Yes.
Yeah, so I thought about a lot of different things, but one that I feel like is very important to its era is the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack, which is primarily the Bee Gees, although it is various artists. They have like 8 songs on there. It's a double album. It was released on November 15th, 1977. It became a cultural phenomenon, really showcasing disco at its peak, not only in the film, but in the songs. I mean, if you had that album, you had all you needed for a disco party. You know, you didn't need anything else. Features songs like Staying Alive and Night Fever, and it remains one of the best-selling soundtracks of all time. But couldn't really talk about it because it's got John Travolta, and one of our featured albums today is from a movie with John Travolta. So we didn't want to double up on Travolta.
Can't have too much Travolta. I mean,
you just wash the hair.
All right, enough about what we almost picked. Let's get into our choices.
You choose me?
All right, for my soundtrack selection, we're talking about the 1994 film Pulp Fiction and its accompanying soundtrack. Features a mix of American rock and roll, surf music, pop, and soul. A few of the notable artists are Dick Dale and the Deltones, Kool and the Gang, Al Green, Dusty Springfield, just to name a few.
Wait, wasn't it Dick Dale and the Dicktones?
The Dicktones? I don't think so.
That would have been way better. That's what I thought it was for years.
Oh boy. Okay. The film, if you're not familiar with it, kind of chronicles the day in the life of four different criminals in Los Angeles. Stars John Travolta, Samuel Jackson, Bruce Willis, Ving Rhames, and Uma Thurman. It was kind of a cultural phenomenon, I would say, in the mid-90s there, known mm-hmm. for its punchy dialogue and violence, and also its killer soundtrack. Let's play one of the iconic cuts from the album. This is from The Rebels. The track is called Comanche. Yeah, one of the songs that I don't think I will ever be able to hear and not think of the scene mm-hmm. from Pulp Fiction. The Rebels are an American surf rock band from the early 60s. They're known for their single Church Key. The track there, Comanche, is featured during a fairly disturbing scene with Bruce Willis and Ving Rhames and the Gimp. I won't spoil any details, but it is quite memorable, to say the least. My clickbait headline for the Pulp Fiction soundtrack is The Brash and the Bloody. Tarantino compiles the ultimate playlist for doing the twist or bringing out the gimp. This is a sort of kind of brash, overblown, sort of graphic film. And I think the soundtrack complements that really nicely. Mm-hmm. It's just loud. There's lots of reverb. Everything is kind of like soaked in soul and surf. It has like a largely focused on the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, it also sounds of Los Angeles because it's a crime thriller, but it's kind of the new kind of crime thriller moving forward for a while, this movie. I think the use of the songs, the older songs in the soundtrack, set a scene of classic 70s movies. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of calling it that with a much more violent modern twist.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of Tarantino's stamp there, the violence and the dialogue. Yeah, supposedly these tracks were selected by Tarantino and a few of his friends who were advising on the film. Let's play a little bit of Dusty Springfield's Son of a Preacher Man. Who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only
boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. That song plays when Vincent goes to pick up Mia Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's effective because I think it sort of sets the sort of romantic or sexual tension between the two of them.
Yeah, it also amps the danger because Mia Wallace is the boss's wife mm-hmm. in this crime family. So you know that Vince's outlook wouldn't be very good if something were to happen there, and it starts to make you nervous.
Yeah. Right. So Son of a Preacher Man was featured on Springfield's album Dusty in Memphis from 1968. I've actually almost done that album a couple of times on the show. Song was written by John Hurley and Ronnie Wilkins. It was originally intended for Aretha Franklin, who turned it
down.
That
would have worked.
Yeah. And this this was kind of a departure for Dusty Springfield at the time. You know, she sort of demonstrated her ability to perform soul music, and it earned her the moniker White Queen of Soul.
Wow.
I guess that's a badge of honor.
Yeah, the song tells the story of a young girl's encounters with a preacher son who teaches her about love. Tarantino has said that he wouldn't have even filmed the scene if he wasn't allowed to use that specific track.
Well,
yeah,
does work.
So, I mean, it's a pretty iconic song. You know, I think that a lot of people knew before, Pulp Fiction. But I think what Tarantino did a good job of was, I guess he gives songs new life or something.
Yeah. Well, to use them in a different way, too. They all get a little tarnished. Mm-hmm. You know, all these classic songs get a little grime on them. And I think that's part of what the appeal was, that this nice stuff got the Tarantino treatment.
And I vaguely remember hearing him say that he didn't want to choose songs that had already been in films. Anyway, my my clickbait headline for the Pulp Fiction soundtrack is, that's when you know you've found a special soundtrack, when you can just shut the fuck up for a minute and comfortably enjoy the music. So that's a play on the quote from Mia Wallace when she's talking about comfortable silences. But I'm not sure why it works as an album. You know, I mean, when you look at the songs and the eclectic, you know, selection, you wouldn't think that they belong together. But there is something that ties it together, maybe an element of mystery or darkness to all of them.
I think it brings you back to those iconic scenes in the movie because they were worked in so well, where the music is being played in the characters' lives. Mm-hmm. It's not just background music. The dialogue pieces used on the soundtrack in between songs, mm-hmm. chunks from the movie, I think really draws you back in. So you're kind of experiencing the Pulp Fiction vibe that you got in the movie from listening to the soundtrack. I mean, I knew people at the time who hadn't seen the movie, but had listened to the soundtrack so much that they kind of knew.
Felt like they knew what the movie was about.
What it was about, yeah. Yeah.
So. They do a nice job with that. There's about a half dozen actual clips from the dialogue from the film. It really kind of helps ground the songs and the scenes together. Why don't we play a cut from the album that plays also in a Mia Wallace scene? So this one, they do a nice job of kind of like showing the music actually playing in the scene on the set. This is "Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon" by Urge Overkill.
She's got that fancy reel-to-reel player.
Yeah.
Yeah, so at this point, Mia and Vince have had a nice time out on the town. He's just supposed to be keeping an eye on her for the boss, and they get back to her place, and she puts on this big reel-to-reel, which no one would do or have this song on it.
She stops it right at the beginning of the song, like perfectly.
Yeah. And so and she's dancing and singing along to it. And Vince is like getting the, dude, don't do this. You're an idiot if you do this. But you can tell he wants to.
You're going to finish your drink, say goodnight, yep. Go home, jerk off.
Walk exactly. Out the door, get in the car.
That's it.
Go home, jerk off. And that's all you're going to do.
This cover of Neil Diamond's classic "Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon," recorded by Urge Overkill for their 1992 Stull EP. This took them to the next level as a band, where their follow-up album, Saturation, actually did pretty well. I guess Neil Diamond at first didn't really want it in this movie. Tarantino had to do some convincing. But Tarantino was a huge fan of the band Urge Overkill from Chicago and discovered it in an Amsterdam record store and felt like it added a layer of unexpectedness that the original version couldn't provide. My clickbait headline to describe the album: "The path of the righteous man is beset on all sides." And this soundtrack brings the fury with tracks that you'll have that'll have you dancing, driving, and dishing out vengeance with style. You know, this album is like a time capsule of 70s cool, which I think is the element that he was trying to bring in, that sort of 70s crime thriller.
Yeah.
With the rockabilly, the surf rock, the soul.
Yeah, we didn't really mention the surf rock is kind of a I guess, gained some popularity after this film and kind of became relevant, I guess, commercially a little bit as well.
Because the movie was a cultural phenomenon, touchstone, whatever you want to call it, the soundtrack, I think, kind of came along for the ride and helped to proliferate that, because then you could listen to the movie in your car. If the soundtrack enhances the film experience, the storytelling in the movie, and then thusly the soundtrack itself can carry you through that, I think it's a success. And this one definitely is to me.
I think that the soundtrack does hold up pretty well. You know, it's hard to imagine it without the film, but they do pair nicely together. So yeah, if you haven't seen or heard Pulp Fiction in recent times, it is available on all the streaming platforms. Give it a listen.
And you will know my name is the Lord when I lay my vengeance upon thee.
Before getting to our next soundtrack album selection, let's hear from friend of the show, Rock Talk Studio.
What was the last really great rock and roll book you read? How about a good rock and roll documentary? Well, that's why I started the Rock Talk Studio podcast, the place to go for recommendations of new rock and roll books and documentaries. Give me 20 minutes and the Rock Talk Studio podcast will get you caught up on the world of rock and roll books and docs from every possible angle and leave you with a no-doubt decision on where to spend your time and money. Want to know what to read next or which film to add to your watch list? Well, here comes all the top recommendations and hidden gems you don't want to miss. I'm your host, Big Rick. Join me for an exclusive look into what's hitting the shelves and the screens and get ready to rock your reading and viewing list. The Rock Talk Studio podcast, your ultimate guide to discovering the best new rock and roll books and documentaries.
Thanks, Rick. I think that's a good bookend to listening to, you know, podcasts like ours about albums than learning more about them through documentaries and books. It's awesome. Go check it out. Rock Talk Studio.
Okay, so my pick for a movie soundtrack comes from the film Stand By Me, which was released in August of 1986. It's a coming-of-age drama film directed by Rob Reiner, based on Stephen King's 1982 novella, The Body. It's set in Castle Rock, Oregon in 1959. The film follows four 12-year-old boys who embark on a journey to find the body of a missing boy. Film stars Will Wheaton, River Phoenix, Corey Feldman, and Jerry O'Connell. And it's kind of known for its authentic portrayal of childhood friendship and the transition to adolescence. The soundtrack is a collection of classic 50s and 60s rock and roll, doo-wop, and R&B. And most of the songs are heard through the boys' transistor radio. During the film. Let's start with the title cut. This actually appears during the closing credits of the film, Stand By Me by Ben E. King.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon.
Stand By Me because the boys stand by each other through thick and thin.
I think that's what inspired Rob Reiner to name the film that, actually. He did say something like that after listening to the song. So the song was originally performed in 1961 by Benny King, who's famously from the Drifters. I think this is the only song on the album that is from the 1960s. Everything else is like in that 1958-59 period. The song was written by King, Jerry Lieber, and Mike Stoller, who together used the pseudonym Elmo Glick.
Wow. Good bit of trivia.
King was inspired to update the early 20th century gospel hymn Stand By Me by Charles Albert Tinley, which was based on Psalm 46. I know you guys all know Psalm 46, so I won't bother quoting it.
Yeah. Stand by me, saith the Lord, I think. No.
No, actually, will not we fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea. So he didn't actually intend for this to be a solo record, but the rest of the Drifters passed on it. So shame on them. So it actually uses what's been known as the 50s progression. Right, we're going to get into some music theory here. So 1-6-4-5. All right. So that, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. You know, anyway. It's, so it's like the first tone in the scale, then the sixth, then the fourth, then the fifth. Anyway.
Okay.
And the film score by Jack Nitschke often refers to Stand By Me. You know, so like you kind of hear it being played symphonically, whatever. Anyway, so my clickbait headline for Stand By Me. Stand By Me soundtrack makes you feel like you did grow up in the 1950s. I don't think I had seen the film, but for some reason I borrowed this soundtrack from a friend. I was probably like 12 years old. And I just got hooked on it. And I'm not sure why, you know, because I wasn't particularly interested in the 50s or whatever. But it was also a kind of a bonding moment with my dad, because I think I was upstairs playing video games, listening to the soundtrack. And he came up. He's like, ooh, I heard Whispering Bells. Ooh, I heard, you know, what are you listening to? And so, yeah, so that was a nice moment. But yeah, for some reason, I'm not sure what it is, but I mean, they're all well-crafted pop songs and simple, and I used to listen to it on a loop. But let's hear more. Here's the first track on the soundtrack, Every Day by Buddy Holly.
Every day it's a getting closer, going faster than a roller coaster. Love like yours.
What's that slapping sound?
Oh, that's me. Sorry. I wonder if that was the 50s progression. It could be. Yeah.
So, yeah, Every Day captures the essence of youthful optimism and that kind of fleeting nature of dreams. And it kind of mirrors the boys' adventure through this film as they journey towards discovering the body that they're looking for so they can be heroes and make it in the newspaper. And I think, you know, that whole feel of that innocence of wanting to be a hero and this will turn my life around. These kids have... Throughout the film, you learn about the struggles of their personal lives. And I think that's also nice because we think back on the 50s as some picturesque moment in America where everything was perfect and these kids had their own problems and they came out through the movie. But in a funny, natural sort of way. And I think the soundtrack really helps carry that through, especially as Don mentioned, listening to those tracks on their radio as they're having their adventure. My clickbait headline to describe the album: the 1950s jukebox that'll make you wish you were in a treehouse with your best buds and a dead body. Yeah, I mean, I like the movie. I think the soundtrack is absolutely perfect for it. And in listening to it, especially since having recently watched Stand By Me again, listening to the soundtrack does bring those scenes to mind and nostalgia of it all. The kind of, there's a narrator telling the story. Richard Dreyfuss is the narrator. So you can view it as looking back on this story. And then when you're listening to the soundtrack, you kind of get that same vibe. So yeah, it's a good one.
Like, did all kids have tree houses in the 1950s? And did they build them themselves? You know, like, it seems like they're all like better at carpentry and architecture.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even when I was a kid, a lot of kids built their own tree houses. You just got scrap wood, nailed it to a trunk and kept putting down boards till you didn't fall off. But I think there was more of a willingness to get hurt back then too.
All right. Well, let's hear a little more. Here's Come Go With Me by the Del Vikings.
Darling, come and go with me. Come go with me. Way beyond the sea. I need you, darling.
Song written by C.E. Quick of the Del Vikings in 1956. It hit number 5 on the U.S. Billboard. I remember this from the film. The boys are all sitting around the campfire in the evening, just talking about, you know, serious boy things that you would do at that age, like if you had to eat one candy for the rest of your life, what would it be? And
Cherry Pez.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that clip always stands out to me. But yeah, they had the transistor radio right there, and this is on the radio. It really does feel like these songs are just like what you would hear if you were growing up in this, like if you were really in 1958, 1959, this is what would be on the radio.
And how rock and roll was this new, exciting thing too for kids to listen to, you know?
And it kind of does have like a goofy sort of nursery rhyme quality, some of these songs, especially with like the barbershop quartet sort of aspect of some of these. It does feel like something kids would enjoy. You know, I enjoy it. It's just kind of something novel about it, I guess.
It's innocent.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds innocent, just like, you know, we think about these kids as well.
Yeah, totally. My clickbait headline for Stand By Me is the 1950s, when a group of boys searching for a dead body was a wholesome good time. I don't know. I mean, the film is so nostalgic, or seems to be so based in the idea of nostalgia, but it also does have this kind of dark coming of age story, which is really what it is. And they are looking for a dead body, one of their own, you know, a young boy. So there's a dark tinge to this, even as kind of friendly and inviting as the soundtrack is. There's some truce in this film as well.
I think when Nas comes back, his next album should be Nostalgia.
Oh boy.
Sure. I've been working on that for the last 5 minutes.
No, that just came up. All right. Yeah. And, you know, another cool thing about it is that, you know, all of these versions of the songs are kind of, you know, the original recordings, sort of the definitive versions of them. For a perfect testament to the enduring appeal of 1950s and early 60s music, check out the Stand By Me soundtrack.
Excuse me, I'd like to ask you a few questions.
All right, it's time for Deep Questions by Don. What songs were ruined or changed by their use in film?
Yes, good question, Donald.
Thank you.
Yeah, this often happens where, you know, you can't separate the song from the movie or the scene. One movie that definitely did that for me was Austin Powers. There's a lot of like 60s pop and stuff that I was not familiar with. So
yeah, baby.
Whenever I hear the Divinyls, I touch myself. I always think of Austin Powers do the Fembots and the whole sequence has just kind of ruined that song for me. But the one that I'll mention too out there is from The Karate Kid. There are a couple iconic songs associated with that. The one I think of the most, though, is You're the Best Around by Joe Bean Esposito.
So the question then, Andy, is did the song ruin the movie or did the movie ruin the song or is it both?
I guess it depends if you're a fan of the movie or the song. But for me, I'll take those movies generally. How about you, dude?
So back to Quentin Tarantino in soundtracks, Reservoir Dogs, the movie that came out before Pulp Fiction. There's that scene with the song by Steeler's Wheel, Stuck in the Middle with You.
Ugh, Jay Billy's Super Sounds of the 70s continues.
Has that Bob Dylan-y sound. It's a very, you know, cool track, nice for the time and everything. But when Michael Madsen's character is cutting off a policeman's ear with a razor to torture him to get information out of him, and gleefully dancing around to the song, not just the song being on, but he turns up the radio because it's on K Billy's Super Sounds of the 70s and is like into it. And it really, that sticks with you. You can't hear that song without thinking about that. And I'm not saying anything was ruined per se, but certainly tainted.
Tarantino has a knack.
Yeah.
Similarly, American Psycho. All right. Remember with Christian Bale, there's at least two scenes there where he turns on a song and kind of starts explaining why it's so great, whatever. So Phil Collins' The Studio is one, and Huey Lewis and the News' Hip to Be Square.
The whole album has a clear, crisp sound and a new sheen of consummate professionalism that really gives the songs a big boost.
Yeah. I'll throw out one more. Free Fallin' got ruined by Jerry Maguire. You know, 'cause remember Tom Cruise is singing it in the car, but hate that movie.
You beat me.
All right. Well, what songs have been ruined for you because of their use in films? Let us know. Hit us on the socials, Instagram, Facebook, and Threads. Also on our website, albumnerds.com.
I went with a 90s favorite of mine, a soundtrack that I think is very complete as a collection of songs that helped support the story of The Crow. The soundtrack was released March 29th, 1994. The movie also released in 1994. The soundtrack is integral to the dark gothic tone. It's a mix of grunge, industrial, and alternative rock, and it reflects the themes in the movie. Grief, vengeance, redemption, and Eric Draven, the main character. His girlfriend was brutally murdered by this set of thugs, and a year later, this crow brings him back, and they go get revenge on the bad guys. Why don't we start off with Burn by The Cure. This opens the soundtrack album. This was the first Cure song like I really liked all by myself. I was never really into them in the 80s. I heard some of their songs, but this one was the first one I was like, ooh, that's badass. It plays at a pivotal scene in the movie where Eric has just been brought back from the dead, and he goes back to their old apartment and finds this Harlequin mask and paints his face to match it. And as he's kind of taking on the character for the rest of the movie, the song just supports it really, really well. Robert Smith of The Cure wrote the track after being shown early footage of Brandon Lee as Eric Draven. Inspired by the movie's gothic visuals and the themes, it's just a hypnotic layered song, and the shimmering guitar lines and the pulsating rhythm really work. And you got to see the movie, but everything is dark and rainy and gothic looking and cathedrally. The two just go together so well. My clickbait headline to describe the Crow soundtrack: who needs therapy when you've got The Cure, Nine Inch Nails, and a crow?
Yes. Crows known for their therapeutic qualities.
Well, you know, that's the James O'Barr, who wrote the graphic novel for this. His girlfriend got killed by a drunk driver, and he was sent into this spiral of depression, and his way of working through it was making this graphic novel. And he was a huge fan of The Cure and Joy Division, and even had The Cure lyrics written throughout on pages of the comic book. So I think this was kind of a full circle thing. But yeah, every song on this just really supports the story. And if you like gothic, rainy, exciting yet depressing, then definitely a movie worth checking out. But why don't we get into another track? This one's called After the Flesh.
That is My Life with the Thrill Kill Cult. You guys remember them?
I do.
I do because of the soundtrack. Otherwise, no.
It's good to remember because we listened to it all week. Okay. Yeah, industrial rock group from Chicago, Illinois. some fame there. I remember them being played on the radio station around here a little bit in the mid to late 90s. The re-recording of their song Nervous Zions, I think is how you would say that. Yeah, I think it fits in pretty well. I mean, the album does have some industrial leanings to it, I guess, the soundtrack. Mm-hmm. That was kind of just becoming a bit of a more popular sound in the mainstream. A clickbait headline for the soundtrack of The Crow is 90s alt rock lends their B-sides for Brandon Lee's B-tier Batman.
Oh, come on.
Shit on me! I don't know. I'm not a huge fan of this film. I think it's a little cheesy or a little overrated. And I kind of feel the same about the soundtrack. I think there's a lot of interesting artists on here, but I think a lot of these songs generally for me are not among their best. The exceptions maybe being the Nine Inch Nails track, Dead Souls. I enjoyed that one quite a bit.
Yeah.
And I wanted to mention too, Helmet is on here. There was a track called Milquetoast. Mm-hmm. I really think they're a very underrated band of the era. They had some pretty cool kind of alt metal.
Yeah. They're hard to categorize, I think, was the problem. Like their album Betty, I believe it was called, was really good, but like no one
really
talked about it.
Onto that.
Yeah, I think it wasn't grunge enough, it wasn't metal enough, yeah. So it was hard. No one was sure what to do with them.
Yeah, they didn't really fit in, but they sound good not coming back to them. But I don't know. For me, this kind of felt like one of those records where like you're like, oh yeah, STP is on it, Rage Against the Machine's on it, I'll buy it. And then maybe you get introduced to some of these other bands that are a little bit lesser known, like a Helmet or My Life with a Thrill Kill Cult. So I think from that angle, it's kind of cool. And soundtracks are good at that, you know, kind of being like a compilation mixtape kind of thing. So yeah, it's pretty cool for what it is. I don't, as an album on its own, I guess it's not my fave, but.
Cool. Hurts a little bit, but whatever. We're all entitled to our opinion. Yeah, I mean, I think it's, again, as with the other records we've talked about, if you like the movie, and I think then listening to this brings it to mind, and that's a good thing. If you're not so thrilled with the movie, then I could see where that element is gone, and it's just about the songs. All right, why don't we get to another one? Let's listen to a little bit of the aforementioned Dead Souls.
So that's Nine Inch Nails, and it's actually a cover of the Joy Division song, Dead Souls, from 1980.
I did listen to that for the first time as a reference point.
Yeah,
I won't say which one I like better because I don't want to hurt your feelings.
And I will tell you which one I like better in a second. But that's...
Well, I think everyone already knows.
So my recollection is that... that's used in the film when he's kind of running across the mm-hmm. roof. I don't remember if that's before or after he does like the first, when he gets his first instance of revenge.
I think it's on the way to go get Tintin, the first guy.
Yeah. So definitely effectively used in the film. And I mean, the atmosphere is just perfect for it. I mean, I think Nine Inch Nails does a good job with this cover. I prefer the Joy Division, I think, just because, believe it or not, it actually, I think, rocks more than the Nine Inch Nails one. The Nine Inch Nails, the rhythm or something is a little more, well, it's got that industrial treatment, so it's less loose. And I feel like something's lost in it. Whereas like the Joy Division one is almost like a punk rock kind of anthem or something.
Yeah, I think I like that guitar riff coming further up to the front in the Nine Inch Nails version of it. It's edgier, but I mean, I thought the both were pretty good, actually.
Yeah. So actually, apparently in the graphic novel, some of the chapters are actually named after Joy Division songs like Atrocity mm-hmm. Exhibition and Atmosphere. Supposedly New Order, who basically is the remaining members of Joy Division, were asked to re-record Level Terrace Apart for the soundtrack. They couldn't get the scheduling worked mm-hmm. out, so they allowed Nine Inch Nails to do Dead Souls. So my clickbait headline for the Crow soundtrack is "Every Night You Too Can Burn and Dream the Crow Black Dream." I think as far as soundtracks go, this really does what it's supposed to do. I think the film and the soundtrack kind of go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. The song selection, really fits that dark mood. I mean, it's kind of Tim Burton-y, but darker, like mm-hmm. even not fun dark, but like real dark.
Yeah.
I think that it's just a good song selection. It's an album I think I can listen to as an album, you know, even like I'm not really into like comic book movies and stuff, but I really like this soundtrack. You know, it's kind of in line with what I like anyway. There's, you know, some other, you know, standout cuts on it. I actually really like the Violent Femmes song on there. It's very different for them.
Color Me Once.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's like a serious song from them, and usually they're, you know, goofballs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But and I like the second side of the album when you start to get some Jesus and Mary Chain and mm-hmm. Medicine, you know, who I haven't thought of in years. You kind of get sort of a dream poppy thing there. So it all, you know, kind of makes for a sort of this fictional, dark, but kind of fairy tale world. So yeah, it's a good album, despite being long.
Yeah, so STP's Big Empty, Stone Temple Pilots, for me, that was the reason to get the soundtrack. And there's nowhere else to get it until the album Purple came out shortly thereafter. But that drove me to it largely, and loving the movie. I saw it opening night. But The Badge by Pantera sounds great. It Can't Rain All the Time by Jane Siberry is the closer on the album, as well as the movie. It's kind of the emotional core. It ties together the film's themes of hope and redemption. So yes, it is dark. Yes, it is brooding, gritty, violent. But there are positive moments throughout. And then the end is a happy ending and a rusting of Eric Draven's soul. Tragically, Brandon Lee, the star of the movie, there was an accident on set and he passed away during the making of the film, which gave it even more darkness and sadness as an undercurrent. So an unfortunate, but his legacy lives on through the movie. So it's a defining soundtrack of the 90s, captures the era's raw energy and dark aesthetic, and it serves as both a requiem to Brandon Lee and a timeless ode to love, loss, and vengeance. So go check out the Crow soundtrack and the 1994 film, not the sequels, and I don't know about the new one.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
All right, fellas, we've been digging soundtracks all week. Have you been digging anything else?
Yeah, got a few things here queued up on the reel-to-reel I can play for you guys. First one for me is from Mabe Frati, Guatemalan cellist. It's a 4-studio album called Sentir Q No Saibes. Oh my gosh, that's so bad. I feel that's so
Sentir
bad.
Wow, K no sabes.
Thank you. Let's just leave it there.
K. Apparently you took French in high school or something else.
I took 4 years of Spanish. Okay.
No, you didn't.
Key?
That's terrible.
It translates to feeling that you don't know. It's kind of an impressionistic pop music with a cello. Let's play the second cut. Really pretty, reflective, kind of take on pop music there.
Yeah, it's dreamy.
Is she like plucking the cello there?
She's doing whatever it is you do to a cello. Just right. All right, that's the last one for me here is from Rich Ruth. He has a new album out called Water Still Flows. It's his third studio album from the Nashville multi-instrumentalist. Let's hear No Muscle, No Memory.
Man, Andy, all that mainstream music has driven you to experimental stuff on your digging this week.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, so elements of jazz there and electronica, kind of modern. The whole thing I believe is instrumental. I really love him, man. He puts out some really interesting records over the last few years. So, Rich Ruth, what you been digging on, Don?
Well, it's not new, but it's been re-released. The Meat Puppets EP, Out My Way, which originally came out in 1986. They're actually going through a period where they're re-releasing all of their work from the 80s and 90s. The Meat Puppets were formed in 1980 in Phoenix, Arizona, by brothers Kurt and Chris Kirkwood, along with drummer Derek Bostrom. Kind of a weird blend of like punk and country and psychedelic rock. Here's a track called She Hot.
Wow.
This is the Meat Puppets?
That does not sound like the Meat Puppets
yeah,
I know.
This was kind of a weird album. It was more...
It's like Talking Heads or something.
Yeah. There's like elements. So it's been like compared to like ZZ Top and stuff too. So it's got sort of like a Southern rock vibe to it. It's not typical Meat Puppets.
Oh, and I wake up in the morning. Yeah. I saw them open for Blind Melon back in like 93 or something.
Yeah. They've got a really interesting catalog. So this was originally an EP, but then it was re-released in 99 with extra tracks. But definitely check out My Way. And then, you know, getting back into the, you know, the Christmas mood.
Doing this to us.
Oh, my gosh. Man.
Mickey Thomas. So you guys know Mickey Thomas from the Jeffersons.
Was he from Starship?
Yep. He's knee-deep in the hoopla. So he has a Christmas album called A Classic Christmas. Yeah, it's actually a pretty short album, so you might like that. Mostly kind of classic tunes. Here's My Favorite Things. Roses and whiskers on
kittens, bright copper. Wow, another original take on a classic song.
Yeah, and I don't think there's any originals on this one, so definitely...
Oh, come on, there should have been a We built this village on Santa's toys or something. Come on.
That's pretty good. What are you digging, dude?
I'm surprisingly digging the new Linkin Park album from Zero. 8th studio album, released November 15th. Features Emily Armstrong as the new lead vocalist, replacing Chester Bennington. And the album blends the band's signature, I guess, new metal. I don't really like saying that. With fresh, dynamic vocals, new sense of purpose. And it does sound pretty modern. Let's check out a little bit of Heavy Is the Crowd. So I've never been a big Linkin Park person, but I was curious about this. And I don't know if maybe the more... sort of ambient sounds of it compared to some of their earlier stuff I was familiar with. I listened to it all the way through once, and I will go back. Not sure how many times, but I was pleasantly surprised by it.
Chester Bennington sounds like a teddy bear. Isn't it kind of? I'm thinking of Paddington.
Oh, the name. The name. Like, yes. Not the, like Paddington.
Not so much a singing voice, but...
Right. God. Or Teddy Ruxpin. Yes. All right. Sorry, Chester. All right. So also because of, you know, soundtrack week, I did recently in the dollar bin at my local record store. Aww. No offense to the soundtrack, Footloose. I found it for a dollar. The disc was in great shape. So happy about that. Released January 1st, 1984. Let's listen to a little bit of the title track. I mean, you had to be there. It's one of those situations. I think the movie has continued to be of interest to people who like 80s nostalgia. But the soundtrack was huge. Everyone I knew, I was like a little kid. Everyone wanted it. Everyone wanted to see the movie because we were kids and we weren't allowed to see it. So, but yeah, for a dollar, hell yeah. Throw that in the collection.
That's a fun one.
Happy to have it.
Yeah. And Kenny Loggins became the king of soundtracks for a while, right?
Yeah. He did Top Gun. Top Gun and Caddyshack as well for Kenny Loggins.
So what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Also on our website, albumnerds.com.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, it's about that time on the show, and I'm reminded of the great American singer-songwriter, Michael Jackson, who said, "Music is the soundtrack to life. It plays the melody of our being."
I wish you had done it in his voice.
Perfect. With that in mind, let's bring out my friend and yours, Wadbot, to see what we'll be talking about on next week's episode.
It's time to step into the colorful, experimental, and electrifying world of New Wave. Next time, you'll explore three groundbreaking albums that defined the genre, blending punk attitude with pop sensibility to create music that still resonates today.
Ooh, Don. Gotta be happy about this one. There's gonna be a lot to choose from. Mm-hmm. Try and pin that down. But yeah, cool. That should be fun. A little more nostalgia for y'all.
What's your favorite New Wave record? What else are you listening to? Leave a comment on our website or email us at podcast@albumnerds.com. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads at Album Nerds. Also, please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app. And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so via PayPal at albumnerds.com/support.
Thank you once again for joining us on the Album Nerds podcast. We'll catch you next time with some new wave selections.
Thanks for listening, buddy. See you next week.
Bye. Yip, 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 yip. Boom, 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 boom. Get a job.
Sha-na-na-na, sha-na-na-na-na.
Ooh, when I get the paper.
Okay. We've gone far enough. When he starts singing like this, it's time to go. Bye.
Nice.